A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. Pope Leo XIV released an encyclical called Magnifica Humanitas back in May, all about artificial intelligence. And he's asking us to unpack the whole concept of an encyclical. What is this tradition? How do Catholics actually interpret these things? Do they land with people outside the church? And do other religions have anything like this? It's a fascinating set of questions because an encyclical sits in this weird space between theology and policy white paper, and I think that tension is exactly what makes it interesting.
It really is. And this one landed on May 15th, so it's about a month old now. I went through the whole thing. It's about 40 pages in the English translation, and it is genuinely substantive. Pope Leo is not just saying AI is good or AI is bad. He's working through questions about human agency, about what happens when decisions get delegated to systems that even their creators don't fully understand, about the nature of work and dignity. It's dits.
Before we get into the content, though, I want to understand the form. An encyclical. What actually is it in the hierarchy of Catholic documents? Because I think a lot of people hear the Pope wrote a letter and assume it's like a divine decree.
And that's the first misconception to clear up. An encyclical is not infallible. It's not even the highest form of papal teaching. It's essentially a circular letter. That's what the word means, from the Greek encyclios, meaning circular or general, originally sent to all the bishops and through them to the faithful. It's the Pope exercising his ordinary teaching authority, what theologians call the ordinary magisterium. It's weighty, it's authoritative, but it's not. The Pope is speaking ex cathedra and defining dogma.
It's more like a CEO memo than a constitutional amendment.
Actually, not a bad way to put it. It's the Pope saying, here's what I think the Church needs to hear right now on this topic. And the form has evolved considerably. The first modern encyclical, the way we think of them today, was probably Pope Benedict XIV's Ubi Primum in 1740. But the real tradition of social encyclicals, the ones that engage with economics, politics, technology, that starts with Leo XIII's Rerum Novarum in 1891, which was about capital and labor.
That's the one everyone still cites, right? Every subsequent pope has written some kind of anniversary reflection on Rerum Novarum.
Quadragesimo anno in 1931, centesimus annus in 1991. The social encyclical tradition is probably the most visible thread, because it's where the Church engages with the secular world on terms the secular world understands. You're not just citing scripture, you're making arguments from natural law, from reason, from observable social conditions. And that's exactly what Leo XIV is doing with AI in Magnifica Humanitas. He's not saying the Bible says AI is bad, he's working through what AI means for human flourishing.
That's the thing that strikes me about encyclicals generally. They're arguments. They're structured. They have premises and conclusions. They cite philosophers and economists alongside saints and church fathers.
And that's by design. The encyclical as a genre assumes a reader who might not share the church's theological commitments, but can still follow a chain of reasoning. There's a fascinating genealogy here. The encyclical form really matured in the 19th century, which is exactly when the Church was losing temporal power, losing the papal states, losing its ability to command. So the Pope pivots from being a monarch who issues decrees to being a teacher who issues reasoned appeals. The encyclical is the literary form of soft power.
That's a really sharp observation. The Pope can't make anyone do anything anymore, so he has to persuade. And the encyclical becomes the vehicle for persuasion.
Leo XIV is very much working in that tradition. The title itself, Magnifica Humanitas, the greatness of humanity, is a thesis statement. He's saying the measure of AI is not technical capability, it's whether it serves human dignity. The encyclical is organized in 5 chapters. He starts with a survey of what AI actually is and what it's doing in the world right now, then moves to the anthropological question. What is the human person such that AI matters? then gets into specific applications, then ethical principles, and finally a kind of spiritual reflection on wisdom and limits.
It follows a structure that wouldn't be out of place in a Policy Institute report. Problem statement, philosophical grounding, case studies, recommendations, call to action.
And that's deliberate. Pope Leo, and I should note, this is Pope Leo XIV, he was elected in 2024, he's Italian, he was the Archbishop of Bologna before, his given name is Matteo Maria Zuppi, he has a reputation as a bridge builder. He was involved in the peace mission to Kyiv and Moscow in 2023. He's someone who thinks about how the church speaks to people who aren't already convinced.
Let's talk about that question of reception. The prompt asks how the faithful actually interpret these things. Because I think from the outside, there's an assumption that the Pope says something, and a billion Catholics nod and say, yes, got it. But that's not how it works.
And this is where the category confusion matters. An encyclical is authoritative but not infallible. That means a Catholic is supposed to give it religious submission of intellect and will. That's the language from Lumen Gentium, the Second Vatican Council's Constitution on the Church. But that phrase, religious submission, is doing a lot of work. It's not obey or you're in schism. It's more like, take this seriously. Assume the Pope has good reasons. Don't dismiss it casually.
You can disagree.
Theologians have been debating the precise scope of that obligation for centuries. There's a whole literature on what's called dissent from non-infallible teaching. And in practice, Catholics receive encyclicals on a spectrum. Some read them closely and try to integrate them. Some know the broad strokes from the homily on Sunday. Some ignore them entirely. The polling on this is instructive. After Laudato Si, Francis's encyclical on the environment in 2015, you saw a bump in climate concern among Catholics, but it wasn't a transformation. Pew found that American Catholics who were aware of the encyclical were more likely to say climate change was a serious problem, but the effect was modest and it faded.
It's not a switch being flipped. It's more like a stone dropped in a pond. Ripples, not a tidal wave.
The ripples depend on how much the bishops pick it up, how much the priests preach on it, whether Catholic institutions integrate it into their programming. An encyclical doesn't enforce itself. It needs an infrastructure of reception. Benedict XVI was very explicit about this. He said the church is not a corporation where the CEO issues directives and everyone falls in line. It's a communion, and teaching has to be received, interpreted, applied. That takes time.
Which means some encyclicals land and some just.
Paul VI's Humanae Vitae in 1968, reaffirming the church's teaching on contraception. That one was received with enormous controversy and widespread non-reception among the laity. Meanwhile, John Paul II's Evangelium Vitae in 1995 on the value of human life was received much more warmly by the Catholics who cared about those issues and largely ignored by everyone else. Reception is always uneven. It depends on whether the teaching connects with what people are already wrestling with, whether the bishops have the credibility to champion it, and frankly, whether the media covers it in a way that makes people curious.
That's the third question. How do these things land with non-Catholics, with other religious traditions, with the broader culture? Because Magnifica Humanita's got a fair amount of coverage.
The New York Times ran a piece, there was a Reuters story, Wired had a long analysis. And I think the reason is precisely that an encyclical sits at this intersection. It's not just a sermon, it's a sustained intellectual engagement with a topic that everyone is already arguing about. So even if you're not Catholic, even if you're not religious at all, there's something to engage with. The Pope is making claims about human nature, about the limits of algorithmic decision-making, about the meaning of work. Those are claims anyone can argue with.
He's doing it from a position that's distinctive. The tech industry has its own ethical frameworks, responsible AI, AI safety, the alignment problem. But those are largely procedural and technical. The Pope is saying, let's talk about the soul.
He's careful about that. He doesn't use the word soul as a bludgeon, but he does ground the argument in a Christian anthropology that says human beings are more than the sum of their observable traits. There's a passage in chapter 2 where he says something like, and I'm paraphrasing, the temptation is to treat intelligence as the defining feature of human worth, but this is a category error. Human dignity does not depend on processing power. That's a direct challenge to the whole premise of artificial general intelligence as the telos of computing.
That lands differently coming from the Pope than it does from, say, an ethics professor at Stanford. The Pope has no stock options. He's not angling for a board seat. He's one of the few public figures who can talk about human dignity without it sounding like a branding exercise.
And I think that's why you saw secular outlets taking this seriously. The Financial Times had a piece noting that the Vatican has been unusually engaged on AI. They hosted conferences, they've collaborated with Microsoft and IBM on ethical guidelines, and this encyclical is in some ways the culmination of a decade of institutional investment in the topic. The Vatican is trying to be a player in this conversation, not just a commentator.
There's also something interesting about the timing. We're in this moment where AI governance is completely up for grabs. The White House is improvising rules. There's a standoff with Anthropic that's dragging into its second week. Countries are racing to build their own AI infrastructure. And into that vacuum, the Pope releases a document that says here is a coherent moral framework. It's almost like the church is filling a void that secular institutions haven't figured out how to fill.
That's a very old pattern. The church steps into the spaces where the secular order hasn't developed the conceptual tools yet. Rerum Novarum did that for industrial capitalism. Pacem in Terris did it for nuclear weapons and human rights in 1963. Now, Magnifica Humanitas is trying to do it for AI.
Let's talk about the fourth question. Do other religions have anything like this? Because the encyclical feels very specifically Catholic. It's tied to the papacy as an institution, to the magisterium, to this whole architecture of teaching authority.
And the short answer is that no other religion has exactly the same thing, because no other religion has the papacy. But there are analogous forms, and some of them are quite interesting.
Walk me through them.
The closest parallel might be the Eastern Orthodox tradition of patriarchal encyclicals. The ecumenical patriarch in Constantinople issues encyclical letters. They use the same word, often on feast days or for particular occasions. Bartholomew I, the current ecumenical patriarch, has been writing about the environment for decades. He's sometimes called the Green Patriarch, but there's a crucial difference. In Orthodoxy, the patriarch doesn't have the same teaching authority the Pope has in Catholicism. He's first among equals, not a universal teacher. So an Orthodox encyclical is more of a pastoral letter, an exhortation, rather than an exercise of teaching authority.
Same form. Less institutional weight.
In Judaism, you have something like responsa literature, the Shila Yuteshuvot, questions and answers, where prominent rabbis issue rulings on specific questions of Jewish law. These are often highly technical and legal, but some address broad social questions. And there are also pastoral letters from chief rabbis, but Judaism doesn't have a single centralized teaching authority, so nothing quite maps onto the encyclical.
What about Islam?
Islam has fatwas, which are non-binding legal opinions issued by qualified scholars. A fatwa can be on any topic, personal conduct, finance, medicine, technology, and some fatwas function similarly to encyclicals in that they're an authoritative scholar trying to apply traditional principles to a novel situation. But fatwas are usually much shorter. They're responses to specific questions, and they don't have the systematic, treatise-like quality of an encyclical. Also, in Sunni Islam, there's no single authority who speaks for everyone, so a fatwa's reach depends entirely on the reputation of the scholar who issued it.
I'm noticing a pattern here. The encyclical works because there's a pope. The form depends on the office.
It absolutely does. And that's both a strength and a weakness. The strength is clarity. When the pope speaks in an encyclical, you know who's speaking and what authority he claims. The weakness is that the whole thing is tied to a single person. If the Pope lacks credibility, whether personally or institutionally, the encyclical suffers. You can't separate the message from the messenger.
Catholicism has that whole apparatus for dissemination too. The bishops, the diocesan newspapers, the pulpits, the Catholic universities. An encyclical drops into an ecosystem that's designed to amplify it.
And that's hard to replicate. Protestant denominations sometimes issue pastoral letters or social statements. The Anglican Communion has the Lambeth Conference resolutions. The United Methodists have their Book of Resolutions. But these are committee documents, not the work of a single teacher. They lack the personal voice of an encyclical. And they typically carry less weight even within their own traditions.
There's something about the singular author that makes an encyclical more interesting as a cultural artifact. A committee document nobody reads. But a pope writing in his own voice, even if he has advisors and drafters, creates something that feels like a genuine intervention.
The encyclical has developed its own literary conventions. They're always titled with the first few words in Latin. They always address the bishops, clergy, and faithful, and often all people of goodwill. They cite previous popes extensively. There's a kind of intertextual conversation happening across centuries. When Leo XIV cites Benedict XVI's Caritas in Veritate or Francis's Laudato Si, he's placing himself in a tradition. It's almost like an academic literature review embedded in a pastoral document.
Which must be baffling to someone picking one up for the first time.
You open Magnifica Humanitas, and within the first three paragraphs you're seeing footnotes to documents from 2015, 1963, 1891. If you don't know that language, it looks like impenetrable jargon. But if you do know it, it's a rich conversation. The Pope is showing his work. He's saying, I'm not making this up, I'm developing a tradition of reflection.
Let's get into Magnifica Humanitas specifically. What did Pope Leo actually say that's distinctive? What's the headline?
There are a few things that stand out. First, he's very clear that AI is not neutral. The technology embeds values and assumptions, and the church has something to say about those assumptions. He's particularly critical of what he calls the computational model of the person, the idea that human beings are essentially information processing systems. He argues this is a reductive anthropology that misses what's most important about being human.
Which is what, in his view?
Relationality, embodiment, the capacity for love and self-gift, the experience of transcendence. He draws heavily on the theology of the body, which is very John Paul II. The argument is that we're not just minds in meat suits. Our physical existence, our vulnerability, our dependence on others, these aren't bugs, they're features. An AI that treats them as problems to be solved is making a theological mistake.
That's an interesting challenge to the whole transhumanist project. The idea that we can upload consciousness or merge with machines, the Pope is saying that misunderstands what a person is.
And he's not just saying it theologically, he's making a philosophical argument that you can engage with even if you don't share his premises. He's saying, look at what actually constitutes a meaningful human life. Relationships, creativity, suffering that has meaning, the experience of beauty, and then ask whether those things are computable. If they're not, then a society organized around computational metaphors is going to miss something essential.
That's a provocative thesis, and it's not the standard AI ethics fair about bias and fairness and transparency.
He's not doing what the AI ethics industry does. He's not focused on making AI more aligned or more fair within its own terms. He's questioning the terms themselves. There's a line in chapter 3 that I thought was striking. He says that a perfectly fair algorithm that allocates resources within a fundamentally unjust system is not a moral achievement. That's a structural critique, not a technical one.
He's doing what the church has always done in its social teaching, refusing to accept the premises of the system it's critiquing.
And that's what makes an encyclical different from a policy paper. A policy paper says, here's how to regulate AI within the current framework. An encyclical says, let's examine the framework. It's a more radical document, intellectually.
What about the reactions? You mentioned media coverage. What did people actually say?
The reactions were fascinatingly varied. The secular tech press was mostly respectful but puzzled. Wired ran a piece that was basically, the Pope has some interesting things to say about AI, but we're not sure what to do with them. The Catholic press was enthusiastic. Crux and the National Catholic Reporter both had long appreciations. The conservative Catholic world was split. Some welcomed the encyclical as a defense of human dignity against technocratic overreach. Others grumbled that it was too vague, or that the Pope was wading into an area where he lacked expertise.
There's always a faction that thinks the Pope should stick to sacraments and not much else.
There's a long tradition of Catholics who think the Church should stay out of social and political questions. But that position has been rejected by every Pope since Leo XIII. The social encyclical tradition is built on the premise that the gospel has implications for how we organize our common life. You can't just privatize it.
The non-religious reactions.
That's where it gets interesting. I saw several pieces from secular commentators who said, essentially, I don't share the Pope's theology, but I'm glad someone is asking these questions at this level. There's a hunger for moral seriousness that the tech industry, for all its talk of ethics, hasn't really satisfied. When Sam Altman or Dario Amodei talks about AI safety, it's framed in terms of existential risk and alignment. The Pope is asking what kind of society we want to live in, what it means to be human. Those are different questions, and they resonate even with people who don't believe in God.
That's the old people of goodwill, addressee actually working. The encyclical is written for a dual audience. The faithful, who will receive it as religious teaching, and everyone else, who might engage with it as a moral argument.
That dual address is baked into the genre. Pacem in Terris in 1963 was explicitly addressed not just to Catholics but to all men of goodwill. This was John XXIII during the Cold War, right after the Cuban Missile Crisis, and he was trying to speak across the ideological divide. The encyclical form has always had this universalist aspiration.
Let me ask a question that might be uncomfortable. How much does any of this actually matter? I mean, an encyclical comes out, people write articles, Catholic influencers tweet about it for a week, and then, does anything change?
That's the question about impact, and it's a fair one. I think the honest answer is that encyclicals rarely change things directly. They're not legislation, they don't have enforcement mechanisms. But they can shape the intellectual climate over time. Rerum Novarum didn't end labor exploitation in 1891. But it gave Catholic labor movements a theological foundation. It influenced Christian democratic parties in Europe. It shifted the terms of debate. The effects are diffuse and long-term, not immediate and measurable.
It's more like planting a tree than flipping a switch.
And sometimes the tree doesn't grow. Humanae Vitae in 1968 was widely rejected, and it arguably damaged papal authority for a generation. But even that encyclical shaped subsequent Catholic reflection on bioethics in ways that are still playing out. The long-term influence of a document isn't always visible in the first month.
That's a very non-tech way of thinking about impact.
Which is kind of the point, isn't it? The Church thinks in centuries, not quarters. An encyclical is an intervention in a conversation that's been going on for 2,000 years. The fact that it doesn't generate immediate measurable outcomes is a feature, not a bug. It's saying we're not going to be captured by the urgency of the news cycle.
I want to go back to something you said earlier about the encyclical as a form of soft power, because I think that's the key to understanding why these documents get media attention, even in a deeply secular age. The Pope has no armies, no economic leverage to speak of, but he has something that tech CEOs and politicians don't have, moral authority that isn't tied to an election cycle or a quarterly earnings report.
That moral authority is the residue of an institution that has been thinking systematically about human nature for millennia. Whether you buy the theology or not, the intellectual tradition is deep. When the Pope writes about what it means to be a person, he's drawing on Augustine and Aquinas and a whole lineage of reflection. That's not something a corporate ethics board can replicate in a two-day offsite.
It's the opposite of hot takes. An encyclical is a slow take, a considered take, a take that assumes the reader is willing to sit with an argument for more than 30 seconds.
That's why the form itself is a kind of cultural statement. In an age of algorithmic feeds and bite-sized content, the Pope is releasing a 40-page document with footnotes and Latin titles and chapter headings. The medium is part of the message. It's saying some things require sustained attention.
Which brings us back to Magnifica Humanitas, and AI specifically. There's an irony in using this ancient, slow form to address the fastest-moving technology in human history.
I think that irony is deliberate. Pope Leo is making a point about pace. One of the themes in the encyclical is that speed is not wisdom, and that the rush to deploy AI everywhere is itself a moral problem. He's calling for what he terms technological discernment, a deliberate, prayerful process of evaluating technologies before adopting them. The encyclical as a form embodies that discernment. It's not rushing to judgment.
Do you think he's right to be worried about the pace? Or is this just the standard conservative impulse to slow things down?
I think there's a genuine concern here that's not just reflexive conservatism. When you deploy AI in criminal justice, in hiring, in healthcare, in warfare, you're making decisions about human lives. If you can't explain how the system reached its conclusion, you've created a new form of arbitrary power. The encyclical calls this algorithmic authoritarianism, which is a pretty sharp phrase for a papal document, and the pace question is real. We're deploying these systems faster than we can evaluate their effects.
That's going to stick with me.
It's a good phrase. and it captures something that the tech industry doesn't like to admit, that opacity plus power equals a form of rule. When a black box algorithm determines whether you get a loan or a job or bail, and nobody can tell you why, you're living under a kind of authority that's not accountable to you. The Pope is saying that's incompatible with human dignity.
That's an argument that travels. You don't need to be Catholic to think opaque decision-making systems are a problem.
That's the genius of the social encyclical tradition. It makes arguments from premises that are accessible to reason, not just to revelation. You can disagree with the theology and still find the moral reasoning compelling.
Let me push on one thing, though. The encyclical form, it's inherently top-down. One man, speaking with authority, addressing the whole church. Isn't there a tension between that structure and the kind of open, democratic deliberation that AI governance probably needs?
There's absolutely a tension. And it's been a tension in Catholic social thought from the beginning. The Church is not a democracy, and it doesn't pretend to be. But the encyclical tradition has consistently argued for democratic participation in the secular sphere. John Paul II's Centesimus Annus is practically a defense of democratic capitalism, with caveats. So the Pope is saying, I'm speaking authoritatively within the Church, but I'm arguing for broad participation in how society governs technology. It's a both. And.
The Pope is not saying I should decide AI policy. He's saying, here are the moral principles that should inform whoever does decide AI policy.
And that's consistent with the whole tradition. The Church claims competence on moral principles, not on technical implementation. Leo XIV is very careful about this in Magnifica Humanitas. He says explicitly that the Church doesn't have technical solutions to offer. What it has is a vision of the human person that should guide the development and deployment of technology.
That's a pretty modest claim, actually, for a document with a Latin title and papal authority behind it.
And I think that modesty is strategic. The more the Church claims technical expertise, the easier it is to dismiss. The more it sticks to its distinctive competence, moral anthropology, the harder it is to ignore. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the early 6th century, a volcanic eruption in the Guiana Highlands blanketed the region in carbon dioxide so dense that Lake Parime, the mythical lake that European explorers would later spend centuries searching for, may well have been a real body of water that simply boiled away over the course of a single dry season. Its entire ecosystem suffocated from below before anyone thought to record it.
All right. To wrap this up, I think what strikes me most about this whole conversation is that the encyclical is a form that shouldn't work anymore, and yet it does. A papal letter with Latin footnotes, in 2026, gets serious coverage in Wired and the Financial Times. That says something about the hunger for moral seriousness that the rest of our institutions aren't meeting.
I think that's exactly right. And it's not just nostalgia or religious deference. It's that the encyclical form does something that almost no other genre does. It makes a sustained, intellectually rigorous argument about what human beings are and what we owe each other, in a voice that's personal and authoritative without being coercive. That's rare.
The question going forward is whether Magnifica Humanitas actually shapes the AI conversation, or whether it ends up as a well-written footnote that everyone respected and nobody acted on.
That'll depend on whether the bishops and Catholic institutions pick it up and run with it. An encyclical is a starting point, not an ending. The real work of reception happens in dioceses and universities and parishes over years, not weeks. So the jury's going to be out for a while.
Something to check back on in 5 years.
If we're still doing this in 5 years, absolutely.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing. This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find every episode at My Weird Prompts. We'll be back next week.
See you then.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu, if something odd is in your your head. Send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird props, that's the close from sloth, from man, from long ear holes. My weird props, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.